We have officially reached episode 6. I have thoroughly enjoyed rewatching and bringing hopefully more attention and eyes onto this documentary, and sad that we only have 2 episodes left before we move into a whole new story. Completely unrelated, I was watching Legally Blonde the other day, and they were in Suffolk County court for that trial, and I was like, hey, I totally know that court. Thank goodness Phyllis Broker, Norm MacDaniel were the judges, because, honey. So last episode, we left off with the decision to grant Sean a new trial in Judge Ball's hands. After 5 months, on May the 5th, 2015, she renders her decision. Rosemary received a copy of the decision while on another trial and immediately went to see Sean so she would be the first one to tell him and not find out from the news.
I was outside. And I got called back to the unit. And I was told that I had a visit. And so I remember being like nervous. I was pretty much scared because if I lost this motion for new trial, like I would have died in prison. Because like I couldn't conceive anything else getting me out of prison or anyone else getting me out of prison.
Rosemary recalled that it was taking so long that she was afraid that they were going to get kicked out, and Sean later told her that he was taking his time because he was afraid of bad news. When he ended up hearing the great news, however, he couldn't believe it. Because of who he is, he was incredibly grateful and thanked Rosemary for everything that she has done for him and for giving him an opportunity to prove his innocence. As we heard in the first episode, Judge Ball worries that her judgment will look negatively on some, in her words, honest and honorable officers involved in this case. Here is where I say, where. We've seen Kelly, Dwyer, McNeely, Asara, Robinson, and Brazel so far, and I would love to hear how any of them were honest or honorable in this case. Dwyer and McNeely still bend over backwards to defend their records and the men involved, while, along with Kelly, creating a villain out of Sean. After a month of fundraising by his family and friends, Sean posts the $50,000 bail on June the 3rd, 2015, and with it gets his first taste of freedom in 22 years. Rosemary says something that was literally stated by her in the Sean Drumgold case, and that if they don't investigate what happened here, how can they reassure that it won't happen again? How sad that there are probably more men in prison because of the antics of the Boston Police Department, especially the E5 detectives, that still have yet to be looked at. As well as the fact that that investigation will likely never happen, because if they are willing to cover up larceny of public funds by a police officer, they would definitely cover up corruption and the rest. The Boston Globe, especially the Spotlight team, always have to expose the issues before action is taken. There was a case from April of this year where the head of the union was exposed by that Spotlight team for sexual assault of children in the 90s. The union pushed to allow him to stay on the job even after an IA investigation found that he had committed the offense. He would go on to continue to do so with a half dozen other children. What else is the Boston PD covering up? When Sean first got out, he stayed with Andre, who was a family friend from his mom's church. They sit down and we start to hear stories of what it was like when he first got out. He used to ask what the curfew time for the shower was, because in prison, you have to do it quickly because that's your vulnerable time where you can get attacked. So the thing to do is to get in and get out. You don't let the shower hit your back. It's not a relaxing time. It's literally a hurry up and get out.
Even though I wasn't in prison, and even though the restrictions and the microscope wasn't there, like, I was still kind of operating. Like, I remember me and my mom going to a store, and there was like an alleyway. And I remember asking her, like, can we go down there? She was like, yeah. Why, you want to cut down there? We can cut down there. We're out here in the free world.
Imagine not remembering your former life, and that life in prison imprints on you so much that you don't remember that you're free outside, that you can take as long of a shower as you want, that you can have a deep sleep and not worry about someone attacking you, that you can eat whenever and whatever you want. The damage the system does to people. On May 5th, 2016, the DA, Daniel Conley, appeals the decision and seeks Ellis's conviction and sentence, life without parole, to be reinstated. Rosemary and the DA's office go before the Massachusetts Supreme Court. Paul Lynn argues that there was no justification for a new trial.
What do we do with a police investigation where the investigators have their own rather compelling incentive to make sure that nothing that arose from that investigation would lead to anything that would inculpate them for their corrupt scheme?
All you have to do and what you should do is follow your 2000 decision, in which case, at which time, all of this evidence, the corruption of the officers,
But not the corruption of the victim.
Right.
I mean, that changes everything, does it not?
No, it's still just impeachment evidence. But I would point out again.
Wait. I mean, there's a huge difference between saying we have corrupt cops who are investigating a murder versus we have corrupt cops who are investigating a murder of somebody who participated with them in that corruption, and the fear that whatever they may elicit in that investigation may disclose things that may inculpate them. Isn't that a major game changer in terms of how one looks at the police investigation?
No, definitely not. There is still no evidence that any of the corrupt detectives procured false evidence in this case. That was this court's holding. That remains true to this day. You simply have an extra motivation.
That the two people who were charged were people who had no motive to kill Detective Mulligan, when in fact, if they had known all that they had known, there were many, many people, for various reasons, who had a motive to kill Detective Mulligan.
But this brings me back to the guns again. You've got the evidence that however this was done, whoever else was involved, Ellis and Patterson were the people who were there with the guns. It all comes back to that.
I think a lot of what Judge Ball is saying in her decision is that this is really about the integrity of the conviction. When you consider all of the surrounding circumstances, you just kind of break out of the what does the law strictly require question, and you ask about fairness and justice, which is what I think, from reading her opinion, motivated her decision to grant a new trial. Is that something that you're suggesting we should ignore?
No, we're here today. We're all here today because we care about justice.
Do you care about justice Because I can't see how you could look at everything in this case and think you're on the side of justice. It's Rosemary's turn. She highlights the tip lines and how it was never investigated. So how can they say that this is a fair trial without investigating everything? She believes because Sean admitted to being at the Walgreens, it gave them a scapegoat. Then we get to the guns. Remember that only Latia's prints were on these guns that were supposedly handled by at least three other people.
Latia Walker, who was the Mr. Ellis's girlfriend, testified at trial, did she not?
He did.
So what would an attorney do with that?
With the information that Tia Walker said that he had the guns. I think that certainly her credibility could have been undermined as well. And there would have been probably an exploration as to what the police officers did in order to get her to tell the story that she told.
So what do we do with the guns?
The guns that are found in this case, I think if we had an investigation from the very beginning regarding the guns, there'd be a different outcome on that.
Did Walker say that she and Ellis went to that apartment where the two women had been killed?
Yes.
With all the yellow tape and everything? Somehow these two people got through the yellow tape?
Both of his cousins had just recently been killed. They're saying now, while the tape is up, my client shows up with his girlfriend, goes underneath the tape, goes into the house, retrieves two guns that they don't find during a double homicide investigation, and then takes them back to her house where she at some point touches or puts her finger on those guns. That's the story that they're telling regarding those guns.
What a crazy story they want us to believe. The Supreme Court rules in Sean's favor. Sean participates in a Flying for Freedom event put on by the New England Innocence Project, where he will get to jump out of an airplane. This event is to celebrate their freedom as well as to commemorate that there are still people fighting for that freedom currently. You can see the weight of everything on his face while he's in the air, and then again when asked how the experience was for him. And my heart just ached for him because he, just like the others, don't deserve what happened to them. It's February 2018, and there are 9 months left before the fourth trial. Sean heads to Rosemary's office so that they can get to work on his case, and she educates him on their options and thinks that a Bowdoin defense is best, where they attack the investigation. On his way to work, he talks about what the job hunt was like. He thought everyone knew that he had been to prison, and like it was a scarlet letter imprinted on his forehead. He got a job about a month after he got home. He started in demolition, and then he got a job at Community Servings, where he first wondered if he would get a fair shot because he had been in prison for so long. Sean is looking at the documents, and he focuses on a report from the medical personnel and that it had listed that Mulligan was deceased upon arrival to the scene. Sean wonders if that means that they were not allowed or not supposed to move him. So he reaches out to Rosemary, and she responds that according to Rule 205, Section 13, it pretty much states that a dead body may only be moved at the direction of the ME or the DA. Since he was deceased on arrival, they should not have moved him. However, they took him as if he was still alive.
Homicide Crime Scene 101. You never move the body before you take photos. And in this case, it was clear that he was dead by the time they got there. And for whatever reason, they never took any photos of his body. They never did any of that, which also fuels that rumor that his pants were around his ankles when this whole thing happened. The idea that they didn't take photos of the body when it was clear that he was already dead is another red flag that something is wrong about this investigation. Almost from the very beginning, when they were missing things that they shouldn't have missed.
What were they missing, you ask? Cell phones. Astaire and Robinson are two of the first to enter Mulligan's apartment. Mulligan had four phones at the time, and they are never really accounted for. Rosemary and Jalise meet with Scott Keller, he is a criminal defense investigator, to investigate the cases in the anti-corruption files, as well as to talk to Misty, who was visited by two cops to ask about the phone call with Mulligan on the night of his murder. Now, back to the car. Remember my warning last week about McNeely? Yeah. You'll hear that in a minute, so pull over or center yourself and maybe don't drink anything until it's done. September 29th, 1993, they take the forensics video where crime scene services come and detail the car. Every cop on and off duty, every homicide detective, and every member of the brass were there to investigate this thing. Feels like too many hands in the pot, but it will be good when something comes up in a bit. They go through the car thoroughly and note everything. They made a report of everything they found, from a cigarette with no brand, a lighter, a pink hairpin, a screw. I'm talking super detailed. No phone was found during the search, so they pretty much stopped looking. In comes Asara, a drug cop with no reason for being there, and he has this bright idea to go back to where the car is impounded and check the car again for the cell phone. And like magic, it appears in the center console. How in the world did 50 men miss this large cell phone in the center console? I took pictures, and I'm going to post them to our Instagram to show you how incredibly ridiculous the notion that they overlooked it is. There was literally nothing else in the center console except the phone, because they had already emptied everything. Okay. You guys ready? Here comes McNeely.
Phone issue was this. Understand how it works. The vehicle come in to the garage at homicide. Other than taking pictures, nobody is allowed near it. That car was never searched. It was never searched until after forensics got finished. And then the phone was found. Well, the talk was, well, the phone was there and was put there afterwards. The crime lab people remember the phone being there. When you talk to the forensic people, they'll tell you they saw the phone. They didn't think it was a big deal. It was a phone in the car. You know, they do what they have to do. And then when they're done, we'll go in and we'll do our search. And that's what happened in Mulligan's car. No hidden secret. There's no conspiracy there.
Okay, let's take a second here. So, you mean to tell me that crime scene thought it was important to note 9 Dunkin' Donuts napkins, 3 bumper stickers, a plastic cup, and a plastic bag, just to name a few things from the report, but didn't care about a cell phone? What evidence were they gonna get from a napkin, McNeely, that would make a damn cell phone irrelevant? Not a big deal. There's a phone in the car of a dead cop. No need to look to see who the last person he called was. Oh, is this a plastic cup, though? No, see, now this is something that we have to document. Get the whole fuck out of here, you pathetic excuse for a man. I have no interest in letting up on this man. Who gave him a badge? Because I need to talk. you're that intent on covering up for these men that you make such stupid comments like that? Is this the best and brightest? Because they did not send their best men. This man probably trained people who were still in the department today. God, this is not good. Not good. Oh, okay. Now, I said that we should center ourselves, so I'm going to go ahead and center myself for a second. But, well, as we expected, the phone had been wiped clean, and the excuse was that the battery ran out. Now, I have never heard of a battery dying, wiping a phone completely clean, but what do I know? Because of this, they don't look into the phone or who Mulligan spoke to that night. Again, who is doing this investigation? Scott explains who Misty is and her relevance to this case. So in 2012, he was working on a homicide case for Zalkin, and Michelle, aka Misty, knew the victim in that case, and Mulligan had also worked on that case. So in his interview with her, he asked about Mulligan, and she said that she had known him for about 4 or 5 years, and that on the night of his murder, two cops had shown up to her place and said that she was the last number he called that night. He is able to find out her new address, and we get to go meet her. So Mulligan used to help her with a couple cases in exchange for sex, drugs, and money for drugs. She was barely of age at the time when they first met. She was under 18. And he would call her during his overnight shifts at the Walgreens and would ask if she could meet him and perform oral sex on him. She described the interactions as violent. She wasn't surprised when he was murdered because he got a lot of people to snitch on other people, and no one likes a snitch. And he also got people to set other people up. On the night of the murder, he had called her, but she was busy. So she said that Bunny, who was a black woman who had been with Mulligan in the past, that she was available and he was okay with it, since she had already been with him before. So she went down with a man by the name of One-Eyed Mr. C. I don't think this is his government name, but that's all we got. He was a maintenance worker who was fed up with the blackmail that Mulligan would perform on a lot of the residents when it came to drugs. So a short time later, Bunny came back and she was out of breath. And when Michelle asked her what's wrong, she said that while servicing, their word, not mine, Mulligan, Mr. C shot him. Misty told the cops that night that had visited her about what Bunny had said. Scott did search for Mr. C and found that he had been murdered in 2005, so he wasn't able to speak with him about this case. There are no statements or files about this interview with Michelle and the cops anywhere. They knew about this incident the night of the murder and did nothing. The ballistics show that he was shot inside of the car, and the initial feeling was that he knew the assailant. None of those things fit Sean or the story that they fed to jurors in the case. That, guys, is the end of this episode. Next episode, our penultimate for this series, we meet the candidates up for the spot of district attorney. Who is going to win? We will find out next week. As always, you can follow me on Instagram at Girl Meets True Crime to see the photos from this episode, as well as on Twitter at Girl Meets TC. If you could rate and review, it would mean the world to me. it will help get our podcast out there for more people to know and hear us, and hopefully help amplify these stories. Thanks so much for listening, and I'll see you next week. Bye.